Welcome to another episode of 30 Minutes in the New Testament. 30 Minutes in the New Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast and check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. While you're over there, make sure you click on that event, that Northwest Arkansas regional event. Still a few tickets left. You can come and hang out with Eric and me and a whole bunch of other people. 2 days of singing, concerts, teaching, fellowship, food. It's going to be a blast. Come hang out April 22nd and 23rd in Bentonville, Arkansas. We would love to see you there. Link is in the show notes, or just go to 1517.org. Find that event. Register up today. It's only $99 for a two-day event. It's going to be way worth it. Eric, we are in the second chapter of the Gospel according to St. John.
We are indeed. And by the way, Dan, when you say there's a few tickets left for the Northwest Arkansas event, I know for a fact that you are not exaggerating when you use the word few. So, folks, if you are interested in going, get that ticket now and know that it might take a little work. It might take a little work to find yourself a place to stay there. It's pretty packed right now, but you can do it. It is possible.
Yeah, say find a hotel in Bentonville, Rogers, somewhere in that area. If you can't do that, get that Airbnb. But, yeah, come hang out.
Yeah. Yeah. We want to see you. So, yeah, we're in John chapter 2. Last week, we ended with the, a pretty famous passage in which Jesus calls Philip and Nathanael. And Nathanael is sort of dumbfounded by what Jesus knows about him. But Jesus seems to know more about him than he should and is convinced that therefore he's dealing with the Messiah that Philip told him about. And now we get into a completely different narrative. It moves on because John, as we'll see really throughout all of chapter 2, does something a little different than some of the other gospel writers do, which is the other gospel writers tend to tell the story in a historical pattern. In other words, it's, you know, this event happened and then this event happened and this event happened leading up to the end.
Yeah, it's more chronological.
Yeah, it's chronological, and John isn't as much concerned with chronology as he is with telling the broader overall story and the purpose for what Jesus' ministry is. So we don't know exactly when this particular event happened in the life of Jesus. What we do know is that it was the first of his miracles, and with that little hint, which gives away what we're talking about, we pick it up at verse 1. It says, on the third day, there was a wedding at Cana in Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. Jesus also was invited to the wedding with his disciples. When the wine ran out, the mother of Jesus said to him, they have no wine. Now, Dan, let's just stop there. First of all, important to point out the context of a Jewish wedding at the time. Jewish weddings were not like our modern day weddings in America anyway, where, you know, you go for the afternoon for a short little ceremony and then you party the night away at a reception. And then you go home and you're back to your normal life. But no, a wedding back then could last up to a week or even longer. It was a big, big, big event.
Just break for the Sabbath. That's it.
That's right. You break for the Sabbath, but you keep on going with the party. And the expectation of the groom was that he would, one of the many expectations, but one of the expectations is that he would provide wine for the entire event from start to finish, no matter how long it was. That wine would be in great supply to the guests. This was just the norm of the time. So when Mary pipes up and says they have no wine, this is a real problem. This is a real issue. And Mary wants to spare the groom and his family from the embarrassment of the guests finding out they've run out of the good stuff.
Yeah, so it seems that this is obviously somebody that the family of Jesus knows. Why else would they be there? And so Mary is trying to save, presumably, a family whom she is friends with, the embarrassment of running out of wine at a wedding feast. And you don't want to do that. And so she goes to Jesus and says, they have no wine. So she goes and finds her son. Mary's one of the, the few people that has some sort of definitive evidence that her son is a little different than everyone else. I mean, she conceived him as a virgin. She had an angel come and give her direct prophecy. Who knows what other sort of things maybe she's witnessed in Jesus' childhood, we don't know. But Mary knows that if anyone can do something about this problem, it's probably her son. But Jesus doesn't seem that he's that interested in this being the first sort of flexing of his power.
This is sort of the great shocker of the passage to me. You know, it's easy to focus on the miraculous event, which I would dare say most of the listeners know about. But the big shocker to me in this passage is Jesus's response, because we have come to expect that when Jesus is asked for a miracle, that the vast majority of the time he hops right to it. And you would expect, especially when his mom asks for a miracle, that he's doubly going to hop to it. And so when you read verse 4, and Jesus said to her, "Woman, what does this have to do with me? My hour has not yet come." That's a little stunning.
Mm-hmm.
Now, first of all, it is important to point out that it might not be as rude as it first seems. When he says "woman" here, it's not the way that you might hear it in our modern day context. You know, not some sort of dismissive, like, "get out of here, woman." You know, it's not that kind of thing. So it's not disrespectful in the way that you would have heard it in the first century. Nevertheless, it is still surprising that Jesus, known for being the miracle worker throughout all of his ministry, at this point says, "It's not my time."
Yeah. So Jesus calls women "woman" quite frequently. This isn't that,
yes,
that uncommon of a thing. And almost every time he does it, or maybe every time he does it, it's actually out of gentleness and compassion. He does this with the woman caught in adultery. He calls her, he says, "Woman, where are your accusers?" He's not trying to make her feel bad. He's trying to make her feel comforted. He says, "Woman, great is your faith," when complimenting the Syrophoenician woman. So Jesus is not, this isn't a derogatory term, as some people might make it just out to be. However, I do think what he's doing here is letting his mother know that she is a woman, and while he is her son, he is also God. And so I think that what's trying to be conveyed here is that he's not being snappy or short with her, but that he's saying, "You are creature. I am the Word made flesh, and my time
you don't
has not
dictate
come
to me. The schedule that I'm on, there's a higher schedule that I'm on."
Correct.
"That I am operating in accordance with." You know, but there is something that Luther picks up on in his commentary on this passage that I think is really significant. And that is that there are going to be times in everybody's life where you're going to come to Jesus with a request, a prayer request or whatever it might be. And at least it will feel like his response is similar. Like, what does that have to do with me? Mm-hmm. It will feel like at times, like, "My hour's not come. I'm not here to do that." And, you know, if you'll permit me, I want to read just a little bit of what Luther actually has to say here. He says, quote, "See how unkindly he turns away the humble request of his mother, who addresses him with such great confidence. Now observe the nature of faith. What has it to rely on? Absolutely nothing. All is darkness. It feels its need and sees help nowhere. In addition, God turns against like a stranger and does not recognize it, so that absolutely nothing is left." But Luther goes on to say this about why God may give such responses or seem to give such responses. Quote, "Because it is necessary to test and strengthen our faith in his promises of goodness to us. We honor God as being good and gracious, even if he acts and speaks otherwise, and all our understanding and feeling be otherwise. For in this way, feeling is killed, and the old man perishes, so that nothing but faith in God's goodness remains." And Luther's point here is a really profound one. It has to do with what we would refer to in our tradition as the theology of the cross, that just because it appears in the moment that God may be even against us or not open to what we are coming to him with in faith, as Jesus does with other people like the Canaanite woman and others that come to him, it doesn't mean that we are to be satisfied or settled with that. Like, "Well, I guess God's against me." No, God's not against you. No, in fact, God may be using this to increase one's faith. And that seems to be the case here with Mary, because right after, and I love this, Dan, verse 5, his mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you."
I think this is hugely important, because a mother knows her son. And so what happens here is that Jesus says, yeah, this doesn't have really anything to do with my ministry, and my time has not yet come, so that's a no. And Mary then turns to the servants. Now, why is this important? Well, who's in charge of serving the wine? The servants. Who has served all the wine? The servants. Who are freaking out right now? The servants. And what are That's servants? Right. They're the lowliest. They're that they have no. She turns Jesus towards those who have nowhere else to go, who have no hope of solving this problem of their own. They can't just go out and buy more wine. They're servants. They don't have money for that. And she turns those people, the lowliest at this gathering, towards Jesus, and simply says, "Do whatever he tells you." And what I mean by a mother knows her son is she, Mary, knows that Jesus will not be able to help himself.
That is precisely right, Dan.
This is a beautiful thing about Jesus, is that when people who have nowhere else to turn are then turn to Jesus, he can't help himself. She knows that he is not going to be able to not help them. He has to.
And yet the way he will do it, as we'll see, and as has already been alluded to with these servants, is he's going to often do his work, even his miraculous work, through nobodies.
Well, what he does here is he sort of splits the difference. He's like, okay, look, my time has not come, so I'm not really wanting to like show everyone this incredible miracle by starting to tend bar at the wedding. That's not really how I want to have my entrance. That's not how I want my ministry to start. So what he does is he does something where only the lowly, only the desperate will know of his power in this moment. He does it in a way where he won't even get credit for it.
That's exactly right. And, you know, the servants have no idea what they're going to be asked to do. And, you know, again, you know, as a point of application, you know, God, could Jesus have just provided wine from the heavens? Could he have just called down barrels of wine? Of course he could. But no, instead, what he's going to do is what we read here in verse 6. Now there were six stone water jars there for the Jewish rites of purification, each holding 20 or 30 gallons. Jesus said to the servants, "Fill the jars with water," and they filled them up to the brim. And he said to them, "Now draw some out and take it to the master of the feast." So they took it. They had no idea what they were doing. They're just being asked to fill them all with water. That's it. These servants don't know what Jesus is up to, but they do it. And what do you know? They've taken part in a miracle. And when the master of the feast tasted the water, now become wine, and did not know where it came from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew, the master of the feast called the bridegroom and said to him, "Everyone serves the good wine first, and when people have drunk freely, then the poor wine. But you have kept the good wine until now." Now, Dan, what is the significance of what he's saying there?
Well, what he's saying is that typically at a wedding feast that's going to last days and days and days, you serve the really good stuff when people are all sober and they're like, "Wow, this wine is so great. It's really just he really went all out on this wine." And then, you know, once people have had a bunch of wine and they start to care a little bit less what the wine tastes like, and maybe their senses aren't all as sharp as they once were. In other words, you know, everyone's a little tipsy. Everyone's having a good time. You bring out the cheap wine, the stuff that no one cares about. Yeah.
That's right.
And this guy is saying, wait a minute.
Yeah, by this time, the Sutter home is being served, you know, and no one cares.
Yeah, and this guy's saying, hey, you did the exact opposite.
Yes, that's
and,
right. That's
and this
right.
wine must have been pretty good, because this guy presumably has had a lot of wine at this point, and he can tell that this is the best wine. Also, we have to talk about this. So you have these jars for the rites of Jewish purification. This is just so ritual washings, essentially. You got to wash your hands and this kind of stuff. It's not an accident that Jesus decides to use water to make something else.
Wait. Are you gonna employ what you refer to as that wet hermeneutic again?
I am. Oh. So Jesus goes ahead and takes advantage. He's like, "Well, if I'm going to do this miracle, I'm going to do it through means, and I'm going to do it through the means that I'm going to create other things." And this is how Jesus creates things. I mean, if you look at the beginning of creation, there is the deep, right? There is the water, and Jesus brings everything. The Word brings everything to life through the water. And what he is going to do as he establishes baptism, and then we've already seen some about baptism, is this is how this works too, that I'm going to bring something different through water. And this is what Jesus does here. Now, also, just so you know, we are talking about Jesus making 150 gallons minimum of wine.
Yeah, that's no small feat.
It's no small amount of wine.
Yeah, it's a lot of booze.
Yeah. So Jesus, first miracle that Jesus ever performs, he makes 150 gallons of wine.
At least, yes. And it goes without saying, obviously, but I'm going to say it anyway. You and I do not believe that this was just really good Welch's grape juice.
No, they weren't like, man, this wine is so great. It hasn't even been fermented yet. It just tastes like it's fresh off the vine. That's not what they meant.
No, that is not what they meant.
And so, you can take that for what it is. And of course, there's a sacramental element to this, too, that Jesus' first miracle is using water, and he turns it into wine. And so you have these sort of representatives of baptism and then also the Lord's Supper taking place here. And one of the best parts of this is nobody knew where it came from, but the servants who had drawn the water knew. So who are the witnesses of Jesus' first miracle? Who are the people that are in the know? The lowly,
the nobodies.
The nobodies, yes. the servants. And who
That's
are
right.
the and who are the beneficiaries of it? Ultimately, the servants, the lowly. And then that goes out to everyone else.
That's right. That's right. This is the way that Jesus' ministry is going to work so often throughout his entire time.
Well, the recipients of the vast majority of Jesus' miracle are the desperate and the lowly.
Still today.
Mm-hmm. And all through Scripture. I mean, you're going to see, like, who is he going to? The lepers, the blind, the lame, the mute, the demon-possessed. I mean, he's not going to go do miracles in Herod's court. In fact, whenever the only times that you see Jesus refuse to do a miracle, as you were saying,
is when he's being asked to do a show for people like that.
Yeah, with the religious leaders or kings or something come and say, do a sign. He says, get lost. I'm not doing that.
Yeah, I'm not here to entertain you.
But if you come to him desperate, like these mm-hmm. servants do, because this is what Mary knows about her son, if you have nowhere else to go, well, this is how you receive the blessings of the power of God.
Yeah. So the passage concludes, this, the first of his signs, Jesus did at Cana in Galilee and manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him. And what all that means really, Dan, is it's not that his disciples didn't already believe in him. I mean, we just have to go back the previous chapter to see that some already had, but they believed in him even more. They're like, oh, he's capable of doing stuff that we didn't realize.
Yeah.
That's really what it is.
Old Nathaniel's like, man, it was really amazing when you saw me under that fig tree, and now you're turning water into wine. This guy's the real deal.
Yeah, that's right. And so it says, after this, he went down to Capernaum with his mother and his brothers and his disciples, and they stayed there for a few days. We do know from the other Gospels that Capernaum was not the most hospitable place to him, and was not the most, I mean, you know, at one point they try and kill him. But John doesn't go into that. Instead, again, referencing the fact that John is not so much concerned with chronology as presenting events and what Jesus is here to do. First, you have him in the beginning of chapter 2, really bringing about the recreation of all things. I mean, he's bringing something new about. He is taking that which was gone and making it into something joyous. That's what Jesus does. Well, he's going to do the same thing, but in a different way as we continue on in chapter 2 at verse 13. It says, the Passover of the Jews was at hand, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. In the temple, he found those who were selling oxen and sheep and pigeons and the money changers sitting there. And making a whip of cords, he drove them all out of the temple with the sheep and oxen, and he poured out the coins of the money changers and overturned their tables. And he told those who sold the pigeons, take these things away. Do not make my father's house a house of trade. His disciples remembered that it was written, zeal for your house will consume me. Now, Dan, there is two ways of understanding this. Some scholars see this as Jesus clearing the temple when he first began his ministry, and then Jesus does it again at the end of his ministry. That could be the case. It could also be the case that John is reporting the one time at the very end of Jesus's ministry that he clears the temple. Either way, for our purposes here, John wants to make it abundantly clear that Jesus has a purpose behind his ministry, which is to really rebuke this sort of class of religious leadership that has trodden down the people, has oppressed the people, has kept them away from the grace of God, has loaded their backs up with burdens that they cannot carry through preaching way, way beyond what the law ever has intended for them to actually hear, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We've gone over this many, many times in previous episodes. And what Jesus does here is basically rebuke them for turning the house of God into a house of trade.
In other accounts of this, you'll see that he drives all of the money changers and the people who are, you know, selling oxen and pigeons and all this stuff. He drives them out, and then it says that the people came like rushing in. And what Jesus is doing is he's clearing a path to God's grace, right? So there's all these barriers put up there, and you've turned this place that was supposed to be a place where you would come and you would receive mercy and grace from God. You could go there and pray, and they've turned it into a marketplace. And Jesus is showing you what John wants to do is show you right from the jump that Jesus is coming to undo the religious system. He's going to, it's not just the tables that he's turning upside down. He comes with the purpose of turning the religious system upside down. He's going to do everything differently.
Yeah. And there is some evidence. Some scholars will point out the fact that where these tables were set up and where the selling was going on could have been in the court of the Gentiles, which would have made it incredibly difficult for the Gentiles to hear anything that was going on and to worship without distraction. And so it would make plenty of sense with what you're mentioning, Dan, with people rushing in to hear what's going on because they hadn't been able to before due to all this interruption in the marketplace. So it makes all the sense in the world. Jesus is saying, my house is big enough to hold everyone, not just this exclusive group of people.
Yeah, and this is why it says the disciples remembered that it was written, zeal for your house will consume me. Well, what is zeal? It's just passion.
Yeah,
right. So passion for the house of God. Is it because of the house? No, it's not. It's not the building that he cares about. In fact, we're going to see very definitively that he doesn't care about the building. But what the building represents that he cares about. So in other passages, you have him say that my Father's house is a house of prayer and you've turned it into a den of robbers, this kind of thing.
That's right.
And so he's the passion for what the house is supposed to be for, which is allowing people to access God.
Yes.
They've turned it into something different. And so Jesus, in his passion for that, goes and flips over tables. And this is a wild thing. I mean, you know, WWJD, what would Jesus do? This has to be within the realm of possibility because it's right there in Scripture.
Yeah. There may be a time. There may be a time where tables have to be overturned.
He doesn't just go in there yelling at people, rebuking people. He's got a whip, dude.
I know. It's not the picture that we typically present or that we're presented with of Jesus meek and mild carrying a sheep on his shoulders.
No, this is Jesus mean and wild whipping some people out of the temple.
That is correct. I'm glad that you found a way to rhyme that too, Dan. Good job. Yeah. So the Jews said to him, what sign do you show us for doing these things? What authority do you have? Who do you think you are?
It's interesting that right away here we see the first example of give us a sign. If you're going to start flipping tables over and running around with a whip in your hand and stuff, you're going to need to show us a miracle so that we can have evidence that this is from God.
Yeah, this is this is the question that is often asked. I mean, you know, what does Paul say in his letter to the First Corinthians where he says Jews demand signs? Well, yeah, this is evidence of that. They demanded a sign in order to see if Jesus was authoritative or not. And Jesus answered them, destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up.
This is amazing. So they want a sign, and then he gives them like this crazy, he issues this crazy response, which is this, oh, you want a sign? How about this sign? Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I'll raise it up. That's a wild response.
Well, and of course, this is one of the things that he's accused of when he's brought to trial. Yep. He's accused of saying that he'll destroy the temple. And of course, as John will point out here, he's not speaking about the physical temple that they're standing in. As it says in verse 20, the Jews then said, "It has taken 46 years to build this temple, and will you raise it up in 3 days?" But he was speaking about the temple of his body.
Well, there's two problems with the accusation against Jesus. They say, hey, he said he would destroy the temple. He doesn't say that. He says, destroy this temple. In other words, if you want a sign, how about this? You destroy this temple, and I'll raise it up in 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
So he doesn't say he's going. He isn't threatened to destroy the temple. He says, you destroy this temple. And, of course, speaking of his body, they do destroy that temple. And, of course, he does raise it up in 3 days. That Though, is there is also this other picture sort of hanging in the background that this temple, of course, will be destroyed, but it will not be raised up.
That's right, because the true and better temple is, in fact, Jesus Christ, and the living stones of that temple are said to be those who believe in him, his church, as Peter declares in his first epistle.
Yes, yeah. Once the temple of his body is destroyed and then raised up in 3 days, there is no longer any need for a physical temple.
Yeah, so John continues verse 22, "When therefore he was raised from the dead, his disciples remembered that he had said this, and they believed the scripture in the word that Jesus had spoken." Now, they didn't remember that he had said that for a lot of his ministry, yeah, as the other gospel writers show. I mean, there's many times that Jesus does prophesy something like this, and they're like, "Oh, I'm just not tracking with you, boss. Yeah, I don't see where you're going with this."
Well, you see that Jesus says that the Spirit will call to mind all the things that he said and did. And it does seem that as the gospel writers write, they start connecting all these dots. You see in Jesus' ministry, they don't most of the time. They don't understand what he's talking about. He speaks in ways that they don't understand. He talks about dying, and they think he must be speaking allegorically or figuratively or something, but they don't think he's serious. And it's only after that body is destroyed, that temple is destroyed and raised back up, that all these dots start to connect and they start to remember these sort of things that he said. And they're, yeah, oh my gosh, like everything that he was saying was foreshadowing what this climactic event of his death and resurrection.
That's right. And so he says in conclusion to the chapter in verse 23, "Now when he was in Jerusalem at the Passover feast, many believed in his name when they saw the signs that he was doing. But Jesus on his part did not entrust himself to them because he knew all people." Now, folks, this is not a flattering comment.
Yeah.
When it says he knew all people, it's implying very strongly he knows that all people have great capacity to turn inward and against him.
Yeah, well, you see this in the conclusion of the chapter where he says, "And needed no one to bear witness about man, for he himself knew what was in man."
Yeah, that's not referring to some spark of the divine.
No, it's not. No. So when it says he knew all people, what he means is he knows what's dwelling in all people. And he knows that anybody could come and perform some signs and wonders, and people would start to believe that they were sent from God. I mean, people still do this today. There's people anyone can come do some parlor tricks, and people would start to get curious. And this is why Jesus doesn't entrust himself to them, because they're not believing in him because of the things he's saying. They're believing in him because of the things that he's doing. Now, there is a sense in which the things that he does validate the things that he says, but they don't care about what he says. They only care about what he does. And that is not faith. That's just sight.
That's right. And so Jesus, and you do see this throughout his entire ministry, where Jesus will garner a very, very large following. And you'll see this a lot throughout John's gospel, where he'll have moments where, I mean, there's just floods and floods of people coming to him. And then he'll say something that is so offensive or so bothersome to the majority of the crowd that then they'll all leave in a flood.
We'll see that in just a few chapters.
Yeah, in John 6, you really get kind of a crescendo moment of that, where even his disciples are like, "Oh, I don't know what to do with any of that."
Yeah, that's a tough one.
That's right. So Jesus is, he is not here to be a man pleaser, because he knows what is in man, but he is here to fulfill God's will, which will ultimately benefit all mankind, because it will provide the path of salvation for all mankind, which will lead to the new life that we have seen displayed all throughout this chapter today.
That's right. Yep. Not a man pleaser, but a man saver. And we going to see next week, as we get into one of the most famous chapters in all of the New Testament, in John chapter 3, that people do have questions about exactly how this salvation is going to take place. I'm excited for next week when we get to hang out with Nicodemus a little bit, but we got to wait. Eric, I will see you next week.
All right. Sounds good.